When you start a senior leadership role in a nonprofit, an NGO, or a philanthropic organization, how should you transition into this new role? What are essential first steps to set yourself and the organization up for success? If this is you, I have some advice for you. It is advice by a thoughtful leader who just transitioned into a major leadership role at Oxfam International, and who is also a thinker and writer on leadership, as well as a coach to other leaders in his free time. Frankly, it's amazing that he can do all of this. Adama Coulibaly, or Cool for short, is who I'm interviewing today. In addition to us talking through his advice on transitioning into a new leadership position, I also took the opportunity to ask Cool about the predominance of Western or Global North-based authors in the leadership and management practitioner, as well as academic literature. To what extent is this a problem? What explains it? And what differentiates African perspectives on leadership from these here to dominant sources? Listen in, you are in for a treat. Hello, and welcome to NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye. My name is Tosca Bruno van Vijveken, and I'm the founder and principal consultant at Five Oaks Consulting. I have over three decades of experience helping leaders in civil society manage change, invest in cutting-edge leadership development, lead organizational culture change, and strengthen effectiveness. I'm also a thought leader on these issues, including as co-author of the book Between Power and Irrelevance, The Future of Transnational NGOs, which is read by civil society leaders across the globe. If you are such a leader and want to look change right in the eye, this podcast is for you. Hello, everybody. This is NGO Soul and Strategy, and this is Tosca. So today we're going to talk about two topics with a really interesting leader and leadership thinker. The two topics are what to be mindful of when you transition into an organization as a leader. And the second topic are what are African perspectives on or African leadership models and frameworks that we all should be aware of. And I'm going to talk to you today with Adama Coulibaly. He prefers to be called Cool, so I will use that same first name. And Cool and I go back a little bit in the sense that he was supposed to attend a senior leadership development program that I used to co-lead while he was at in an earlier stint at Oxfam and was sadly not able last minute to go. I then, years later, read a stellar LinkedIn post by Cool about leadership transition, about his own experience when he became international programs director at Oxfam recently. Cool also has had a pro bono consulting practice and coaching and mentoring practice about leadership before he rejoined Oxfam, and he writes really thoughtful blog posts from time to time about leadership in our sector. So I knew I just had to interview him. So welcome, Cool.
Thank you. Nice to be part of this, and thanks for having me.
Oh, I'm very jazzed to hear you talk today. So listeners, Adama Coulibaly is a seasoned leader with nearly 30 years of experience in international development and humanitarian aid. He currently is the Global Programs Director, as I said, at Oxfam International. And earlier in his career, he was also a Regional Director at Oxfam. He has held leadership positions as a country director at IRC, the International Rescue Committee, regional director at Plan International, and he was a principal advisor at UNICEF, amongst others. He is also, interestingly enough, a certified transformational coach and founder and mentor of Positive Minds, And he calls himself a positive thinker, which we're going to talk about right away. So cool. Let's talk a little bit about yourself. Why do you call yourself a positive thinker? And why did you call your pro bono consulting, coaching, and mentoring practice that? What does that mean?
Good question. Anytime people ask me this question, my direct answer is usually, I'm a born positive thinker. And I think somehow the whole thing came from, let's say, my childhood. I was born in a very tough condition during the famine in my home country in Mali. And then went to school during those very hard conditions.
Yeah.
And I think very early in my life, I have to understand that actually I need to start seeing the positive side of the world, because there was so many negativity spreading around me. And the only way for me, let's say, to get out of that negativity is to start to see the world around me differently. And I think my whole positive thinking started from there. And as I grew and then started my career, I actually make it part of me. And it's really, positive thinking is my mantra, if I can say it like that. Because I say always to myself, why bother to focus on the bad side and the negative side of the world if you can still see the bright side? And that's really why progressively that I am a self-proclaimed positive thinker. And I think people around me, if you ask them, can you say something about cool? 80% of the time, the first thing they will tell you is positivity.
So you're very congruent with your objectives.
Exactly.
Interesting. So it really comes from a very personal, from the beginning of your life, the origin of your life and what you had to face and how you chose to respond to that, right? Yep. So from a mindfulness perspective, how we respond to reactions that are outside our control is one of the few things that we can have some agency over. Very interesting. I had to smile for a moment, just sidebar, but because for me, living as a European here in America, sometimes I am struck by what I call the relentless positivity and optimism of American culture. And that sometimes I feel a little bit like, okay, let's tone it down a little bit. But you have a very good reason why to be born a positive thinker. Now, do you feel by labeling yourself a positive thinker, is that in any way also a commentary on some of the leadership models and frameworks that you have been exposed to, trained in, read about, etc., or not necessarily? Is it something to distinguish from some other things, or not really, not necessarily?
I think it's a combination of both. As I said, I'm a born optimist and a positive thinker. And obviously, as I grew up and then started my career in the international development, and I actually started reading also about the theories and practice of positive thinking. And I actually read a lot about positive thinking during the COVID. Not for me, but because I wanted to actually be equipped to actually support my team to go through that very difficult time. And I think during those days, I realized that actually scientifically it has been proven that positive thinking is actually good for our health, for our mental, for virtually everything. And I think there are tons of studies demonstrated that. And to me, that was really, I wouldn't say an eye-opener, but at least it reinforced my conviction that actually I'm doing the right thing to be a positive thinker. And then using the scientific discoveries to actually back something I had strongly believed in for many, many years. And I think, yes, that's why I said it's actually both. That's all I can say.
I have two follow-up questions. One is What should people do who find it hard, just temperamentally, to be a positive thinker? And my second question is, are there limits to positive thinking as a leadership state of mind?
Yeah, it's interesting. The first part of the question, I think it was last Saturday, one of my coaches reached out to me. He had received as a kind of a 360 feedback report, shared it with me, and then he made a comment, oh, this is a great feedback, but there is one comment, someone saying this. Of course, that this was negative feedback. and then we entered into a conversation, and I said that, why are you focusing on that small negative thing? Yeah, but I want to understand because I want to improve. I want to know. I don't know why this person is saying that. I said, why are you not focusing on the whole wealth of positive comments you receive from others? Then he paused. I said, don't let really that very small black point actually overshadow your greatness.
Right.
And he went back and yesterday he called me again. I said he really thought about it and he has changed his mind. He will be focused on the positive. I think at time, what people need in this particular situation is just to, for someone to actually make them realize that it's good and better for them to focus on the positive side of things. It doesn't mean dismissing what is negative. Because that wouldn't be really, that will be what I call utopia. And it's not about positive thinking, it's not about being, it's not about utopia. And that brings me to the limit of positive thinking. I tend to call myself a realistic positive thinker.
Okay.
Because if not, you may end up actually dismissing everything that is negative. I mean, negativity is part of us. Negativity is around us. Negativity is in the world. So it's very, very important to be aware of those and actually try to see how do you balance that negativity with the positivity around you. And I think to me, it's not about ignoring, let's say, the eclipse. But it's about understanding that the sun is still shining even behind the eclipse. Yeah, that's how I really see it. Yeah,
which is also something that we are told in guided meditations, right? So that that underneath the all the variation in daily life, all the challenge and all the suffering that is, as the Buddha would say, is also inherent to life, there is always this constancy of also that there is sun and there is some things. Okay, so let's move now into the first of the two big topics that I wanted to discuss with you, and that is, how should senior leaders best transition into a new job, whether it's a new organization to them or whether it's a new identity, a new position within that organization? So you wrote this really excellent LinkedIn post. We'll be sure to put it in the show notes. For those who haven't read it yet, can you summarize point by point what you said in it, please? And may I stop you from time to time for a moment to ask a follow-up question, if that's okay with you?
Sure.
Yeah?
That's okay. Yeah.
So I'll just remind you of the first one, unless you have it in front of you, or shall I just kind of prompt you for the first one and just let you expand?
Yeah, you can. Yeah? Whatever works for me. Yes, yes.
Okay. So the first thing you said, always take a break before taking on your new role, whether in your current organization or a new one.
Yeah. And I deliberately put that one as the first one because I myself in the past, I realized that there was specific job transition where it was actually just a week transition. And I think it has nearly set me for failure because you know, during that week, you continue receiving requests and, you know, emails and things like that from your past organization. And while your new organization is expecting you to step in. And I think it's kind of a really create a kind of blurred transition for you.
Yeah.
And then I said to myself that I'm not going to fall again into that kind of situation. So I always make sure that there's a minimum of 2 weeks break between two jobs. Ideally 1 month, that at time is hard, but I think to me the minimum is really two weeks. It's allow you to kind of let's say transition well, stop and breathe before jumping into your new role, and making sure that there's a clear kind of break between the old and the new
one. I was going to ask you about that. Do you also, so you're saying indeed, you know, 2 weeks break, ideally a month at least. Do you also, as part of that, insist on a clear break from the old organization? How do you do that?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, what I usually do is actually the first week I'm willing to, you know, receive repairs and all those kind of things, depending on maybe there are still things people would like to come to. And then I say from the second week, it's really a cutoff break. And then I will say I will only accept specific requests from the person taking over from me, to kind of facilitate the onboarding of that person. And usually this means that your relationship, the former organization, will go down to one person, either the person taking over from you or the interim person. And I think it's important to really make that discussion. Otherwise, people keep coming to you about everything and nothing.
Good point. Yes. Yeah. And there's a whole separate literature as well as practitioners who have written up their findings are around CEOs transitioning in and out, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And when and under what circumstances and accompanied by what types of explicit protocols or agreements, et cetera, is it desirable or appropriate for an old CEO to still be play some role in the nonprofit or NGO after they have left, right? So that's another very interesting topic, but slightly different from this one. So let's move to the second. Your second point in the LinkedIn post was, there is not time for induction and a time for work. They overlap.
Yep. I know some of my HR colleagues challenge me for that, but it's the reality. Maybe if you are in a kind of a junior role, yes, there's a time for induction. You go around and people make sure you learn everything maybe for 2 weeks a month before you step into the role. But if you are a senior leadership role like myself, induction and work overlap. And that is the reality. And I think to be psychologically prepared for that is very, very important. You if you say to yourself that there's a honeymoon period, I mean, you are lying to yourself. The moment you step into the role, people expect you to deliver. That's why I said, actually, there is no time for induction and a time for work. They overlap. Of course, you need to make sure that you deliberately set aside time, maybe with the support of HR, to have those specific blocks for induction.
Mm.
But at the same time, making sure that you actually transition progressively to your role. And that's why I said that the 2 weeks breaks also are important, because you can use part of that to actually not do your induction, but at least to understand as much as you can from the organization you are joining. And I also said that it's not only about moving or changing organization, it's actually also changing job in the same organization. And you have to give yourself that 2 weeks break. It's something I didn't mention.
I see. Yeah. And even maybe you have any commentary, I'm just probing spontaneously here. When you come back into the same organization, but in a higher, with a higher positional power than you had before, which is often the case, and you are relating to and have to work with people who you used to be at a at the same level with before. Any leadership lessons about that particular context, how to navigate that?
I mean, my approach to that is actually very simple. One of the first thing I do, and which I did when I joined this position, is actually reach out to those people. They're usually the first people I will reach out to. You know, we were colleagues and we had good work well together. I mean, now in new positions, and then I need your support so that I can succeed. And then I tend to plan my first call with them. And there's always one question I would ask to them, but also to many other people, is that if you were in my shoes and in my position, what would be the do's and don'ts?
Nice.
Yeah. And then you cannot imagine that how many I learned from those conversations, particularly for those people who were at the same level. I think giving that respect and consideration allows people to open up and be themselves, be honest and frank with you. And that's how I approach it.
I love that practice. That's a very good idea. And you, so you end this particular point in the post, you say, first of all, in the post on day one in the job, you start solving problems. The fact that you're new does not change this. You are expected to be operational right away. So use your break time, referring to the earlier point we discussed, to learn as much as possible about the new job and the organization. That will reduce your learning curve. Yeah, excellent. I'm learning a lot already. Going through your third point, setting healthy boundaries early or pay a stiff price later?
Yeah, I love that one because, isn't it? It's in any relationship. It's not only about job. In any relationship, if you don't kind of set healthy boundary early, then this means that there's no boundary. And then you cannot actually complain about people crossing the boundary because you haven't set any. But at the same time, it's actually the most challenging one to actually do when you are joining as a newcomer to an organization, because with the enthusiasm, you tend to actually allow everything. Anything people ask, you are a volunteer because you want to demonstrate that you are enthusiastic about things.
Yeah.
But as I said, if you behave like that, you really pay a stiff price later. Yeah. So it's very, very important to do that. And the way I did that is very, very simple. I started with my own team, and particularly my direct report. I sent to them actually each of them, it wasn't a group email, each of them to say that, okay, I'm coming to this job, looking forward to working with you and supporting you. You know, X, Y, and Z are my commitment to you. But these are also my boundaries, and make that very clear from the very beginning. And I think that's helped me a lot because people have known those boundaries. For example, one of them he said that, if you send me, for example, an email outside my kind of working time, I may or may not reply, but don't expect a reply. You know. So then people will not just kind of start chasing me on WhatsApp and or Teams to get a response. So that's one simple thing, for example.
But important.
Very important. Another simple thing was around meetings. I said, well, don't expect me to kind of join meetings and those meetings overrun, because you know I plan my meeting ahead. So come the time, if it's not ended, so I leave. So then when I leave the meeting, people know that I'm not being rude because I had communicated that boundary from the very beginning. I mean, there are a few things like that, and I think it's very, very important to communicate. You said they're very simple things. They're not complicated. Very, very simple and practical things.
No, but actually the second one, you're actually, in my view, that might not, this is me interpreting that second boundary, and I and this might not be you, but you're actually also modeling that most times it's really important for meetings to end on time because that means that we need to structure them well and have good agendas and blah, 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 right?
Yeah.
So you're actually, to my mind, you're modeling something that's just a good practice besides modeling self-respect, boundary setting. So,
Indeed.
So your tip here, if I can read from the post, is always take the time to understand the future implications of your initial decisions before taking them. This will ensure you retain the social capital you built initially.
Indeed.
The fourth point you made is resist, and I loved this one. It's almost counterintuitive, but it's so true. You said resist the urge to change the existing. Tell us more.
Yeah. I mean, I have seen countless time in my career when a new leader joins, people just change everything. And usually it's their way of kind of demonstrating that I did this, I did that. And at times, even if I can be cynical, it's probably also a way of enriching their own CV. You know, I came and joined, and then I did this, I did that. The end result is actually frustrating people.
Yeah.
Disregarding past achievement, and most importantly, maybe demonstrating to people that you are the smartest guy or in the room, which actually, as I said, can actually be very counterproductive. Maybe 2, 3, 6 months down the road, because you may end up finding yourself alone. Because those are things people have worked very hard. Think very hard to actually put them in place. You cannot just come and try changing things. So my approach as a leader is always to kind of build on what is in place. And if I has to change something, it will come from my conversation with people, clearly asking them that, okay, what need to be improved, adjusted, or changed? And then that will come from them. Just to give you an example, my first 2 months in the job, I did exactly 87 one-on-one.
Okay, you count them.
Yeah. Yes, I counted them, varying from 30 minutes to an hour. And then actually the do's and don'ts, and then what to keep, what to improve, what new things to make in place. And I would use the continue, stop, start framework for that as well. And putting all those together actually helped me to clearly understand that what I think people are happy for and I need to keep and continue, what I think people believe I need to adjust and improve, and then what I think people think that are missing, and then we need to start working on. Yeah, that consolidated view. And then when it's presented back to people, everyone kind of recognize themselves in it.
So you do actually present your overall, your collective impression from those one-on-ones, initial one-on-ones as you come into the organization, back to, you reflect it back and say, this is what I heard you say. And that starts to generate the first buy-in, if you will. Now, you may have, of course, you as an outsider, let's say you're a total outsider to the organization, may have some observations, as we know about organizational culture, for instance. You may observe some things that are completely no longer visible to those who've been inside for a long time, right? That's pretty value to that, would you say, or not? that you bring in something that was not said by the 87-101s.
I mean, the good things about the 87s is kind of a mixed group.
Yeah.
So you had people who had been at the organization maybe two to three months before I joined.
Okay.
And you had a long timer that has been around for 20 plus years.
Yeah.
And then you have, you know, people in our northern affiliate in UK, America, France, and the likes. And you have people in countries and regions. And then that mix, actually, then you are able actually to have an overall picture. Even things you had in mind will one way or another way will come from those conversations. So you don't have to say finally that this is my point of view. Okay. I mean, that's most of the time it's like that. So then you don't push forward your agenda because it will come naturally from those conversations.
Got it. Interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. And by the way, building on what is in place, if we think about the kind of research and the good practice around having challenging conversations is similar, right? If we can, in our communication, even if our own thinking is different from what somebody has just said, we can still try to build on the parts that somebody just said that you like.
Exactly.
And then say add something else, right? So it's just sidebar, but it's a good communication technique that many of us don't always think about. So, okay, yeah. Let's move to the last point because I want to get to that second part of the interview as well. Mm-hmm. So the last point you said is prioritize external engagement from the start or you risk getting stuck internally. I love this one, Paul, because my observation is, and my opinion, this is an opinion, this is a point of view that can be challenged, of course, should be challenged, is that when I ask leaders in senior leadership programs in our sector, how much of their time they spend internally with colleagues within the organization and how much do they spend externally? And when I say externally, you're kind of hoping that will not just be people in the sector, but also people outside the sector, right? Of NGOs and nonprofits. They tell me 90% internally.
Yeah.
I find that frightening.
It is.
So talk to me about this point.
Yeah. It is frightening, as you said. And I guess my learning from it, from my previous experience of in Oxfam, is indeed, I wouldn't say it was 90%, but I could say it was probably at least 80% when I was a regional director. And it was not only frightening, but I think it was also very, very frustrating. Because in the end, as a leader, if you are not able to engage externally, and scan the external environment.
Exactly.
So it means definitely that the day you wake up, maybe you will be going completely at the wrong direction.
Yeah.
But also mean that you cannot actually, as a leader organization, contribute to the innovation because innovation happens through external interaction. Because I think we know everyone internally. I honestly don't think that it's through the internal interaction we innovate. It's actually through the external interaction we innovate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. For the listeners, you cannot see this. I'm sparking my hands because I love it. It's so important. Keep going.
Yeah. And I think then when I joined back Oxfam, I said, no, not again. So I made it very clear, including when I was setting objective with my line manager, I put an objective there and I said that, okay, you sign off this. Therefore, you should understand that I will be spend at least 50% of my time externally. And with the aim, actually, to move in progressively towards 70-75%. Percent.
How is that going so far? I'm really curious.
Yeah. I mean, so the first 3 months, I must confess, the first 3 months has not been possible. The induction, trying to understand the organization. I had left three years coming back, many things changing, and also coming at the time where we are actually going through our horizon thinking process. That requires quite a lot of investment and time internally and energy internally. But from my fourth month, I joined in May, so completing very soon 6 months, in my 6 months. So from my fourth month, I actually started being deliberate about it, reaching out to my peer from other organization. And I think somehow we have agreed collectively now to set up a group and having some kind of quarterly meeting. Mm-hmm. Reaching out, actually being deliberate about being a member of some of the global, gatherings, like the whole SCHR, which is the whole issue around sexual harassment issues, protection issues in our sector. Right. I think those organized group actually deliberately being part of them. So I'm mm-hmm. part of three now, representing Oxfam, and I'm kind of engineering the fourth one, which is around the pledge of change.
Right.
So I think if you kind of deliberately put yourself forward and be in those spaces, then it's a commitment. You know. Then you have to deliver on those commitments. I think this is what I'm doing, and that's taking me progressively, outside the internal issues. And being like the last thing, being really deliberate also about visiting countries. Just to give you one example, all my month of November, virtually all my month of November, is about going to countries. I'll be spending 2 weeks in Latin America, 2 weeks in Asia. Mm-hmm. And I said clearly to regional director that, yes, I want to meet my team, discuss with them, and motivate them. But equally important, partners. I want to sit with them, discuss with them, listen to them. That's also a way of doing that. So kind of flipping the whole purpose of visiting countries to make it external focus, partner-centric.
Yeah. Okay. There's more follow-up questions I would love to ask, but I'm going to hold myself back from doing that. But that sounds like some excellent practical things to protect your calendar, right?
Yeah.
Literally. Yeah. Okay. So you said, and in this, just to finish off on the blog post, you said the tip is to avoid being the center of power and decision making by empowering your senior colleagues to take responsibility for their action. All right, let's move in our remaining time to the second topic that I was so interested in, and that is, I want to ask you, as an African, about where you think currently, but also historically, where is the thinking about and doing and articulating, if you will, of African leadership models and frameworks? So just to introduce it briefly, often when we, especially white people from the global north like myself, when we try to be helpful by, for instance, offering some form of senior leadership training or coaching, etc., team coaching, etc., the question will be asked, a critical question and a very legitimate and understandable question is, why is so much of the content that we are working with here, what I call Global North imprinted, right? Mm-hmm. Coming from the Global North, often specifically also from America, I continue to find it striking while living in America that so much of the content is also US dominated, right? Mm-hmm. So it's a very good and legitimate question. I won't go into what my colleagues and I have done in the past to unearth African models, but I always want to keep learning new ones. So can you talk to us a little bit about African leadership concepts, models, frameworks, directions, whatever you want to call it, that you feel are distinct from Global North imprinted ones? Which ones you think have added most value to the global leadership thinking?
Yeah, that's a good thing. I mean, clearly there are some common themes when it's come to leadership. I think the common theme definitely is actually as how do you use your power and influence to actually lift other people up, whether from the West or from the North or global South, global North. I think this fundamental principle of as a leader being actually the person that will be lifting up other people, and whatever way you do that and mechanism you use for that, it doesn't matter. But I think to me that's the core principle that kind of let's say transcend geographies and culture. Now coming to Africa specifically, I guess the to me it goes down probably to, let's say, having done some kind of read about what Ofsted has written about culture. I think it goes down probably on the cultural norms difference between different part of the world. If I take the US and Africa, the US in a sense tend to be more an individual society
Absolutely.
with actually a lot of things centered about individual success. While in my part of the world, it's a collective society, therefore things are centered around a community. And my mother always say to me that because I've been lucky and fortunate to have this kind of job, not all my friends and colleagues. And my mother always said that what you have or earn is for the community.
I
And then
see.
you approach leadership in that in that in that in that in that in that way. So when, let's say, coaching someone from this part of the world, it's not the whole person you are coaching. You are coaching the whole person within his or her community. And understanding that dynamic about the community around is
Yes.
extremely important. So if you ask me, I think to me that's really the main difference. You are not coaching and managing or mentoring an individual. You are coaching and managing and mentoring an individual within a community, and you have to take that community into account because it's probably 80% of how the person will show up.
Yeah, that's very articulate. Yes. And you know this, of course, a lot better than me. That makes sense to me. That is a distinct difference. I'm thinking about, one of the most well-known ones that we in global leadership programs often use articulate is Ubuntu, and the idea that I am because you are, and that strong interdependency, right? That I am not an individual that is apart from the community. And apart from others, we are very interdependent, which of course is also, I think it's also expressed in Buddhism, isn't it? So that to your mind is the biggest distinction, and something that, are there particular names or authors or names of that philosophical framework that you could help me and help our listeners with that we could look further into?
I mean, I have no scientific method and evidence to demonstrate that, so it's probably going to be empirical. I mean, if I could give a name to it, I mean, I guess the name could just be the Ubuntu leadership, something like that. It's
And
it's
if
probably
there
about
is a
that, yeah.
particular source or, as I said, authors, a collective group of authors, practitioners who've really reflected on that, if later after this recording, if some come to mind, I'd love for you to educate me and also our listeners, and we can and put it in the show notes. So maybe something to follow up on. That would be wonderful. How?
Yeah, I mean, I guess maybe just a small note on that one. Maybe yeah. That's because I'm coming from I'm from Mali, and I think if you read the whole Mali Empire's story, okay. Which, as you might know, was actually one of the largest empire on the continent, spanning from the 13th century, the early 13th century, until toward the end of the 17th centuries. And I think the first master, which was the emperor, was Sunjata Keita, and he was really renowned for I think his leadership was really renowned of kind of being collective leadership, and he wouldn't take any decision by his own, and I think that has kind of has gone on, at least in the Malian culture and in the many culture across West Africa, because the Mali Empire was actually covering the whole of West Africa virtually, and I think that's also maybe I don't know, but some research is. At least if you go back as far as to the 13th centuries, can explain some of the actually thinking when it's come to leadership. Yeah,
that makes sense. Well, definitely, I'm very interested. So I will follow up with you and see if there's one or two sources or resources or authors that come to mind. Would love to learn from that. Yeah. Well, with that, we have to bring this interview to a close. We're coming up on time. Where should listeners go if they want to learn more about you, Cool, as a leadership, as a leader, as a leadership thinker and doer? Because I just think you're so thoughtful about the doing.
Yeah, two spaces, actually. The first one, obviously, would be my LinkedIn profile, but specifically my newsletter on the link in the LinkedIn, because this article we're discussing is actually part of my newsletter I call Positive Minds. And then I have a personal blog, adamakulubali.com, where also I quite publish a lot around positive thinking and leadership. And people also can go there. I think I'd be happy to receive comments from the many blogs I've written there as I engage people. Yeah, that's where people can learn more about me.
I have to ask one last, and I promise this is the last spontaneous follow-up question. Where do you find the time to write?
Many people ask me the same question. Even one of my colleagues asked me yesterday, and they keep asking me. I say that to me, it's really first, I get inspiration from my daily interaction, and at the end of every day, usually the night before I go to bed, I kind of write a few paragraphs on something that has inspired me. During the day, and I use an app for that. It's called Gratitude. Yesterday I was at 486 consecutive days of kind of writing into that. That's how it. And then at the end of the week, on Saturday or Sunday, I kind of go through those to see among all those things I've put that during the week. Yes. What is the one that has most inspired me the most? And then I try to write around that. So that's really how I do. But, as Aristotle said, we are what we repeatedly do. So, and I think because I've been writing, I don't know for how many years now, and consistently, so writing has become part of me.
Yeah.
So then it's kind of right now I don't really think about writing, trying to structure and things like that. I just sit and write.
It's an because awesome
I've been doing it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And of course we know that writing things down helps you to further think through them, process them, and articulate what are the key points that come forth from it, right? Yeah, but I've been so struck by how you do that across everything I've read from you, if that's the right English. So, well, we have to bring it to a close. So thank you so much, Cole, for this really interesting conversation. I would like to talk more about with you offline about African leadership models, philosophical frameworks, etc., and concepts. So thank you for your insights. And thank you.
Thanks a lot. It was a big pleasure. Thanks a lot.
Oh, wonderful. I'm so glad to hear that. So listeners, if you found this podcast stimulating, as I did, then be sure to check out other episodes on my podcast, NGO Soul and Strategy, that focus on leadership thinking in our sector, such as episode 49 with Martha Holly Newsom of Medical Teams International on the interesting topic of women top leaders in faith-based organizations. And Cole's colleague, John Samuel, also at Oxfam, and also a very deep and interesting leadership thinker, that is episode 52. You can find those episodes and more, not just on my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, that is with the number five, but also on my YouTube channel. Subscribe to my email list and you will always be the first to be in the know. So with that, this is Tosca, and I look forward to spending time with you next time on NGO Soul and Strategy. Thanks for listening to my podcast. If you valued the content, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Spotify so that other leaders of social change organizations can find it too. And if you want to learn more, have a look at my website, fiveoaksconsulting.org, where you will find blog posts, recordings of interviews with me, as well as information about my co-authored book, Between Power and Irrelevance: The Future of Transnational NGOs. If you sign up for my email list, you will receive a free sneak peek at the book. Or feel free to email me at tosca@fiveoaksconsulting.org or contact me through my website. And follow me on social media, LinkedIn, Twitter, and Facebook. Till we talk again at NGO Soul and Strategy, the podcast for NGO leaders and managers who look change right in the eye.